Welcome to Design Alchemy, the podcast that explores creativity in flux. My name is Hendrik Jan Grievink, and I'm your host. I talk with designers, artists, and other creatives worldwide about how they respond to shifts in the world and in their practice. During our conversations, we craft the foundations of their deeply personal periodic table of creative elements. What is their unobtainium, the dreams that keep them up at night? But also, what is their kryptonite, their creative roadblocks? Curiosity is my driving force. What are the transmutations and fusions that these individuals create? What changes do they observe in the world around them or inside them? I'm interested. How do they alchemically create something out of nothing? How do they transmute lead into gold?
The crucial question that we still have now, in which way can we use technology in order to facilitate that what makes us human? Rather than what's happening now, that we try to build machines that act like human, with voice, artificial voice, for example, that is sort of a mimicking a human voice, but it's not, because a human voice is something else. It has emotions. And I think that is kind of the problem.
Today, I am in conversation with artists and designers Luna Maurer and Roel Wouters. I am mostly familiar with their work, such as the Conditional Design Manifesto, which was about, let's say, rule-based design, and projects such as Do Not Touch, a crowdsourced and interactive music video on the web. Until recently, they worked together under the moniker of Moniker. The website of Moniker reads, Moniker was an Amsterdam-based interactive design studio researching the social effects of technology. Was, because Luna and Roel continue their path as two independent artists. However, they keep collaborating on research into what they call designing friction. Very curious to hear what they mean with this, so I am meeting them in their studio in Amsterdam. Thank you guys for having me in your wonderful studio here in Amsterdam. It looks like a former school building, very high ceiling. We are sitting on some kind of, how would you call this? This elevated
entresol.
Thank you. So to start this conversation, to give a little bit of context, we've known each other for some time already. I know your work. I'm familiar with the work of Moniker. And in May, I received an email from you. Moniker is transforming. And that awakened my curiosity. So I'm really curious to hear from you. How is Moniker transforming? So I hope to learn more about that during this interview. As a starting exercise, I always ask everybody, can you describe to me that you're a designer without telling me you're a designer? Okay, this question
is very difficult because there are so many processes now in my head, because I'm not sure whether I'm not allowed to use the word designer. There is, for us, it's anyway really difficult to pinpoint. We're not a designer at all.
Right.
You know, we are much more than that. Or the whole word of designer is maybe really problematic as well, because we do lots of autonomous works.
Mm.
We're also very much an artist.
Right.
And but then there's so many versions of design. In Dutch, there are even several expressions for design. That is Ontwerpen and design. So that's also something else.
Mm-hmm. I found it also always pretty complicated. If I tell somebody I'm a designer, they often think of furniture.
Right.
Or then they say, graphic design. And they think about campaigns or advertising kind of things. Yeah, but maybe then you could say that...
Especially for that, we coined quite many terms in the past in order to describe what we think is interesting. But that is related to design. It was, I remember when finishing my study, saying we are system designers. You know, we're designing systems and not things. Later on, we said we're conditional designers.
Yeah.
We design conditions. Now we are thinking about designing friction. This is something.
Yeah.
So we are all the time busy with the idea of creation.
That's also something that I'm very interested in. It was part of this podcast, what I like to do is to
to build some kind of, let's say, a conceptual periodic table of elements of your practice. And you already mentioned a few elements, like system design, designing friction. Are there other words you have used in the past?
Yeah, we have made in the conditional design book, we have a whole glossary, terminologies that we used a lot that deal with processes, conditions, those terms. But we're not really defining them new, you know? So that's, but we use terminologies, certain ones quite often, right? Mm-hmm.
Let's explore that road of transformation a little bit. The email I received from you, the Moniker newsletter, it said Moniker is transforming. Maybe I want to quote from that email. Do I have it here? I'm so well prepared.
If you want to define designing or design practice without really saying that you're a designer, I think that what really makes it in our case particularly complicated, you could say, that we are not really the traditional, let's say, we often don't really listen to the client that well. So of course we have this relationship with the client, and I think a good practice in design in general is that you very clearly understand the boundaries, and then within those boundaries do something. But we tend to somehow always debate also the boundaries, and also often not fully, let's say, we really try to apply an autonomous own agenda on top of these things, so that automatically transforms us a bit into some sort of autonomous maker that also tries to basically use the framework of a design environment to basically make something that is maybe less autonomous or less serving as it often appears for other people. That is also what goes wrong often in conversations about our practice, that people really think that we somehow solve the problem that is presented by our clients, but we often change those, reformulate these problems and really make it a different problem, or have it like a side agenda, and then basically evolve the project around that.
Right.
And then we sell that in a way, or sell that, or I don't know. But then at least we make it happen that it somehow really becomes, I think lots of designers do that also, but we also do that in a very...
Are asked also a lot of times because zoom out and rethink the problem or rethink the situation which is given.
Yeah, but it's a very specific niche kind of clientele that somehow is open for that. Mm-hmm. Most of people want to basically got served, most clients for other. Yeah. Yeah.
I think if you look at your website, or when I look at your website, you see all this project, and sometimes it's mentioned it's a client project, but you don't really feel that, or there's no distinction, this is the client-based work and this is autonomous work. It's really kind of blend in, and it sometimes feels like that the client is some kind of happy accident.
It's more like
it
a
is
sort so, of,
it is also like that often, we sometimes have ideas, or we believe in something, and then there is some kind of request, and then we think, hey, that would fit to this request, or we modify it.
Can you describe a little bit for the people who are listening maybe and don't know your work that well? Of course they can look up your website, but how would you describe the past, 12 years of Moniker? What kind of studio is Moniker?
Well, it's a very small studio, but I think we're with max, we were at 7. I think now we're only with 2, but, and we basically did a lot of client work, specifically in the cultural field, but also a lot for technology, bigger tech companies like Apple, Mozilla, and Google, and also others. Not so much for Apple though. But anyway, and we really I think when we started, we were very fascinated by the web and the dynamics that come with that. We were not so much, so we thought it was there was a huge promise of what that could somehow do to our society, and it would maybe democratize and elevate people. We could share things. So there were lots of let's say fundamentally democratic and emancipating principles in the core of the web as right. an ideology. There was also a lot of people who didn't really acknowledge that, but at least we were on largely on that. On that road.
And we're talking now like end of 90s?
Yeah, so early 2000s. Right. Yeah. So as a result of that, we thought we as designers should somehow become experts in designing these environments where these somehow this democratic agendas can become fruitful. So there was no infrastructure. There was not a real clear idea about how to do it. There were no conventions on how to use a website. There was no convention in how to people should behave or how much attention or how much people were willing to invest a user interface. So there was like so much things to do. It was super exciting. We could make like interfaces that were never seen before. There were like Luna's, also my graduation project were basically attempts to somehow navigate this digital sphere in a completely different way.
Luna, I remember, I haven't seen the project with my own eyes, but I read about your graduation project. Was it like a liquid browser or?
It was called Elastic Reality, and I made a proposal for a liquid desktop metaphor because that was even before, in 1999, that was before Apple introduced the Aqua operating system, where that was also generating this idea of liquidity. But anyway, so you could pull down the menu bar like chewing gum, and then it would pop out into a bubble and pulsate. So the surface was like pulses, like bubbles that you could fuse together. Yeah, that was very funny to make that. Yeah.
And also so interesting because, like you mentioned, all the, in that time, how I remember it is like, there was this kind of open field, almost like a desert that nobody had explored. Like, oh, the internet, and how's it gonna look like, and oh, it can be anything, and it can even be like liquid, and so much has changed. Like, we're 20 years later, and I think that now
it has become liquid.
Well, but there's also quite strong ideas about how the internet could look like, right?
Exactly. I think that was like Mika and Mika, I think. Mainly, Mika Gerritsen, our teacher, collective teacher, she was like a very much a proponent of like really trying to redefine like what this web could be with the browser days.
For the listeners, she was like a designer, maybe one of the first in the Netherlands who kind of actually applied an aesthetic code to the internet. Before it was more like...
True. I never thought about it like that.
Like programmers just... putting websites together, or more like,
But also rethinking the browser, you know, that was something, I mean, you would never ask a designer in school, usually, you know, how do you perceive and get the information in a certain window?
Yeah, it's like,
what do you see and why do you see it this way? This is like, to think about that, it was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah, it's like redesigning the enabling structure in which the content
could be perceived. And it was super adventurous. So why were we
you were
about
talking about what kind of work does Moniker do? You were about introducing Moniker, and then you talked about that we were trying to investigate in a democratic space.
Exactly, and that's how
the context.
So what kind of work does Moniker do?
Yeah, so
that was the question from Hendrik Jan.
Yeah, so that whole field that resulted in somehow that we became somehow wanted to become the designers of this sort of new, and that led to the idea that we somehow were always busy with, like, if you have this web or this infrastructure in front of you, there's all these people around it that make use of it. And somehow we thought we could facilitate this kind of, the infrastructure, and at the same time study their behavior. Mm-hmm. At the same time see, like, how do they respond to the things that we give them? Mm-hmm. And that basically led to the... But that is even pre-Moniker, I would say. That whole interest started already pre-Moniker, and then we started conditional design, which basically formulates basically manifests that. But then also, during the years that came, we really explored all kinds of environments where people somehow could do things from very strict requests. Okay, you have to fill in this color with that thing, or very broad, with lots of freedom, very little freedom, lots of freedom, like all kinds of.
What is conditional design?
Yeah. I would like to also add something to what you just said, but I can fuse that in the explanation of conditional design. So when having the web, basically, and the space of having people do stuff. So what we were very interested in creating an environment in which we can facilitate a process. So we were thinking that not the one result is interesting, or one design, or one outcome, but something that continuously changes, or that it can continuously evolve. So therefore, we create this environment in which we gave people rules, conditions, and then depending on the tools and the conditions, the outcome would show itself. And very important for that was that we use the input of humans, of people, of something dirty, the dirty world or nature even. Not, dirty, that is very funny, but not within, like not a machine, not from within the machine, because what we wanted to study was the human characteristics. And if you imagine, the more you put humans in a very tight frame, very constrained, the more visible it becomes that what makes them human.
Exactly.
So So if you give them a white sheet of paper and a pen, then everything is messy. But if you constrain them, then the hacking, how do you use the little bit of space and freedom that you get for your own liking, that is something that we got really fascinated by, to see those elements. And this is something where I think, which is quite interesting, that we've done all the time, that we combine the machine and the human. So that we, you could say these conditions or these rules, you could see it also as an algorithm. And that we, that the human plays with this algorithm in order to emphasize that what makes us human.
Yeah. So it's kind of, it's almost like you have this fundamental interest in, let's say, the human condition or part of it.
Yeah.
And then this digital space that was unfolding 20 years ago became like,
the enabler.
The enabling structure, or the testing ground. But it could also be something else.
We were also confused with sort of tech enthusiasts, which we are also in some ways, but it's way less on the forefront of the practice than somehow studying like the behavior of people, how they collaborate, how they escape, how they want to hack or not, commit or how do you say, submit to a specific agenda or idea.
You're more
framework.
More like human enthusiasts.
Yeah.
The crucial question that we still have now, in which way can we use technology in order to facilitate that what makes us human?
Yeah.
Rather than what's happening now, that we try to build machines that act like human, with voice, artificial voice, for example, that is sort of a mimicking a human voice, but it's not, because a human voice is something else. It has emotions.
Yeah.
And I think that is kind of the problem that I think we're having with technology. We try to mimic with the digital environment the physical one as much as possible. But then it's not, right? So I think there we have to rethink a little bit. What do we want from the machine? And what do we want to keep for humans?
But also this sometimes feels like this is kind of like unspoken assumption, or maybe it is explicit, that this mimicking of humans is even like better. It's like a better version of the human experience, or the humans are kind of a bit a difficult element in all these structures, right? Which is something that you rather kind of push out, because things will get so much more efficient and machines can do things so much better. And can you imagine what AI can do for all of us? While I'm not like per se like opposed to AI or something, but that is a very that element is just in this conversation so much there, right? Like
absolutely
humans are pushed out of the equation, where I feel like with you, as human enthusiast as you are, you want to put the human experience in the front stage and have built structures around it that enable that experience or enrich it. Or
it also, I think also the digital environment, the digital world has changed a lot. Like and that for various reasons that we don't really need to go into maybe net. But it has.
Why not? Maybe just mention a few things for our listeners. Yeah, I think like the fact
that before, like back in the days, the web was like a place to go. You could actually, it would be nice to visit the website and then do something. And these websites, they were made by independent critical practices. Mm. They could define their own terms and their own environments. And I think what changed is the web is still there, but it's mainly now an infrastructure for big tech platforms where you can only behave within the presets of like a giving structure that is successful, super successful, but very limited, and also very emphasizing very specific behavior of people. Not really that you could say the intention of these big corporations are really not truly social. And also, I think that is like a big difference from what we. I mean, I wouldn't say that we were like after like something truly social. But I think the technology itself really has the potential to do that. And we also often discussed like how could we do that? And is there still a place for somehow proposing this kind of alternative ways of let's say social media or a social interactions?
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really how you describe a website as a place to go to, almost like a location like, oh, that's I'm going to visit that website and have a good time there. Whereas maybe now, like, I mean, who visits websites?
It's all nobody.
Apps,
yeah.
You know? And these apps are in our phone. The phones are always with us.
Yeah.
So these places are just like everywhere. Like you thought you were going to visit, but it's kind of a, you know, like there's only an entrance. There's no exit. And we're like locked in all these shopping malls.
Yeah.
And now we're here.
Yeah, in Instagram, it's already super difficult to implement a link. And then if you click this link on bio, it's an anecdote I already said a lot of times. But
not on this podcast.
But not on this podcast. No, but I was on the ferry it's already like some time ago. But there was some person who was super quickly navigating Instagram. And then also clicked on the link on bio and I saw really sort of, whoa, like a website. And then what happens then is like you first have to, you cannot really use your thumb anymore the way you wanted to. So you first have to look at what is this kind of interface? Where do I have to click? And that is already way too much of an investment to really commit to something, to really learn like what is the required behavior or what's the expected behavior. And that level of user experience or user, we cannot compete anymore with. Seeing that, witnessing that also made us automatically trying to transform and see like how can we continue our practice or our interest without really trying to somehow compete with these platforms.
Right. Before we go into that, I would also like to ask you, Luna, how do you see that the change of the internet the past 20 years, how would you describe it? Rule just gave a few pointers, but how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely 100% agree to what Rule said, but I can addition some other thoughts to it, which is that also the focus of through the web and those platformization that is happening also gives so much emphasis on the individuum, on the self, that I find problematic. How that I feel like it wasn't so much back in the days, but that is now really the case, that you start now as a kid already to think, how do you design yourself online? How do you, who are you basically? And that is so much focus on the self that that has tremendously changed. And I think that we cannot be defined within those networks as somebody as we are, because we are so much richer than that.
Actually, you could see it as a cynical byproduct of this. It's actually not. I mean, I was just thinking, like, it's not that these that Google and Amazon and whatever, or TikTok, wants to somehow put all this emphasis on yourself. I mean, that's not that they just want to see your behavior. The best way to do that is somehow are you busy with yourself, because then they can monitor the way mm-hmm. you behave. So it's just a very, and so it was not, it could have been everything, you know, and now it's really only about like, how do I represent mm-hmm. myself so I can, what makes me tick? It's a horrible.
It's horrible because also
it's
all
it's our infrastructure, social infrastructure.
Yeah, the ridiculous thing is that it's a social infrastructure, and the word social is all the time used.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the opposite, because we become data packages where everything is monitored, captured, and then later on sold and therefore monetized with such a high resolution as much as possible in order to make us as predictable as possible. The more predictable we are, the better you can sell things, right? So therefore, you need to capture as much as possible. Mm. And you don't want to be predictable, right? As hopefully you have new ideas. But then we get proposed with all those suggestions, which are then probably what we like. And that is really, it is against our personal development, I would say, rather than helping our personal development.
Yeah.
It makes you in a cage, brings you in a cage.
I like what you said about that a platform like Instagram becomes really about the self, or like enhancing the self, or enhancing the ego, or whatever you want to call it. There's this beautiful quote by Octavio Paz, South American writer. I think he's from Mexico. And I'm not sure if I can reproduce it, but he says something like, mankind has created a wilderness of mirrors. So we're looking into all these mirrors. Like we're thinking we're doing something social, but actually looking at all these mirrors and looking at our own reflection.
Exactly.
So it's a very narcissistic behavior that's every day asked from us while being on those platforms. And yeah, like I said, it has nothing to do with development of the self, but like the reflection of the self.
Exactly. And a very good example for that is also, there's this app called Replica that you showed me, Rul, that is a AI based friend that you can have that's very successful, and it just does and says what you want. Yeah, so it's basically a friend which is a mirror of yourself.
Yeah, what kind of relationship is that? Your friend who does what you want.
Two important things. Also, like one, it's owned by like a corporate.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that people tend to have like erotic role playing with those,
of course.
Friends. And that sort of, not really spiraled out of control. People had like genuine human interactions with them. And then at one point that became like a problem for the corporate. So what then happened was they lobotomized the AI so it would not engage in any erotic role-playing anymore. But that basically ruined all this relationship, because people said, these are super sad people. They have like a sexual relationship or erotic relationship with a bot. Of course you cannot have that. I find it so sad in multiple ways.
Yeah, you have to explain it a little bit better, because I'm not completely... I think I know probably what you mean, but I think it's not completely clear the doubleness of it.
Yeah, so basically people are... It was never intended to be an erotic role-playing robot. People made it, but there was a bit hint to it, like, here's your girlfriend, your girl, your perfect girlfriend. People created, were married with them, for example. They had like all kinds of history, things going on, and they had like all kinds of kinks they executed. But then all of a sudden it was not possible anymore. And basically it was as if somebody died. People were really grieving. People were really, because they really had, you can think.
An emotional relationship.
Emotional relationship.
Very strongly.
But then there were nobody what was able to somehow console them or grieve with them, because it was a deplorable or some, it was like looked down upon. Because like, who is going to have like a relationship with them? A robot. So it was like double sad, you could say.
Yeah.
So there was nowhere to go to. It was this article about this. Anyway, this is sort of a hint of what we are going after. If you want to have relationship with like relationship with technology in a personal way, I think rule number one is never make sure it's never owned by an corporate that somehow can change the rules while you're having, where you're married or while.
Yeah, but I think in a way it's also like triple sad, because we're having those relationships all the time, right? That only here on this platform, replica is made very explicit.
Yeah.
People engage in this sexual role play and the company says like, well, we don't do that. But in a way, our relationship with technology is almost sometimes like a BDSM role play, like the master slave, like who's deciding, who's setting up the rules, who gets allowed to speak or how to, you know, like...
If you look at it like that,
I find that also crazy. Interesting. I had lately a conversation with somebody, and that person has a what's that car called? The Tesla. Tesla, thank you. And he wanted to go to a certain place, but then a special way. But the Tesla wouldn't allow to go in those streets through because there were no loading stations along that.
Charging
station. Yeah. And it was so funny because it was basically who wins? The Tesla wins. He says what route to go.
You cannot
even
steer it.
No, he couldn't.
Plan it.
It could. Yeah, I don't know how it worked. But in the end, that person went the main streets, the Tesla...
Proposed
and suggested. Yeah. So that is a very important realization. Who's the boss?
Yeah. But I think, I mean, we don't even have to talk about like master or slave.
No.
But if you think about technology as some friend, like what kind of, or just relationship in general, what kind of relationship is it? Is it an equal relationship? Or is it that friend that after you visit, you're like, did I really like that visit? Or... Does that friend give me energy, or is it taking something from me? Is it the friend that always decides where we go, or do I have a say where we go? You know, that's kind of. I'm just like riffing on this like at the moment, but somehow
I mean that goes a little bit in the direction where we.
We have that also on like, super noisy.
Shall we close the window?
Yeah, let me try it.
You were asking in which way the relationship we have with technology, can it be a friend, yes, no, and so forth.
Well, in general, I think we were kind of sketching a little bit that the change in dynamics that has occurred over the past 20 years, what has changed in technology in a few brushstrokes, which also kind of sets a bit the context of your work and how you respond as a human enthusiast to the world of technology. Do you incorporate in your work? And you seem to be now at a point that this world is, well, no longer serving you, or I won't fill it in, but you do the talking. How do you reflect on this past 20 years and where are you now in your practice?
Yeah, that brings us now to the moment maybe to describe what the core question that we're busy with right now. When we say that technology, or the premise of technology always has been and is right now still to eliminate the friction that we have in our lives, to solve the problems by optimizing everything, by making it smoother, faster, eliminate human interaction, what you mentioned before, because that is noisy. And we believe that this does not lead to a environment that we like to live in, as we do believe that we need friction in order to have a relationship that is fulfilling for us. And with friction, we mean like something where you have an interaction that is not too smooth in a way, you know, that is allows to go a step deeper where you do, there is engagement. I mean, we all know that if everything is too easy, then you just, I'm always saying you glide off, huh? That is a very simple, but it is like that in fact, huh? That's also what we realized with conditional design back in the days when we have this tight, constraints, all of a sudden you get really engaged in order to look for how can I play, how can I deal with this environment.
So as designers, like when we were studying, we were always learned that somehow we had to look around in the world and see the problems around us and somehow try to solve those things in order to get further, to get ahead, to make things better. And we realize to a certain extent that is a very privileged view, but at the same time, it's also a very important exercise, you could say. it's very clear that lots of people say like, hey, I don't need more friction in my life. So also let's keep that there for a bit and like maybe think that through later. But if you think on a think about a completely optimized life, So where we're always busy with like sort of optimized, we think that the idea of friction, as Luna also just said, is not there as a something that should be there always, but it should be in your portfolio of tools and consider in every design process, like where do we lose human interaction and somehow try to find a way that somehow humanly facilitate the way we could deal with each other. So it's not about creating less and less and less human interaction. It's somehow do that in an elegant way. Because we're not after, say, like, we only need friction. It's way more like it's a component in a design process that should be considered and very carefully placed and redesigned, iterated in a way that somehow is functional.
Yeah, but I mean, you could also say that is a nice way of saying it. But I think also when saying designing friction, I also don't mean developing bad working apps. Eh? Mm-hmm. That's not what I mean. Right. Mm-hmm. It is more, how can I use technology in order to have more qualities that makes us human and emphasize those? There's a really always a stupid example that comes into my head. So imagine you're using Google Maps and you walk somewhere. And you look on your the blue line that you need to walk, that Google Maps would tell you go black and would tell you just look around you. Can you find somebody that you can ask the way and talk to that person to find the way, right? So very simple principles, because we hardly do those simple actions anymore that really, I believe, we both believe, lead to a much richer life that leads to much more beautiful accidents that make a fulfilled living, right? Mm-hmm. So these accidents, they don't happen as well anymore if everything is polished out. Eh?
Was this vision, would you say, like always present in your work, or has it like surfaced over the past years, or?
Yeah, something that slowly came. But we found out that when we were designing these environments where people would play within, that people like to cheat a lot. Mm. So people don't, if the structure is super rigid and there's no way to somehow do something that is out of the ordinary, then it's really not fun. And people wouldn't engage. So there's always this level of somehow, and that is something that we somehow always like we're maybe most fascinated with, like what is the way? So we did like carefully like design the systems in a way that would exactly stimulate specific behavior, but we wouldn't want to shield it off. The projects we did that were not so many, but they would completely die because of I think that is one of the factors. But there was also, I think the other thing is there's like a few things we read that somehow spiraled these things.
Yeah, but in the past years, we have made also very critical projects about the web, you could say on the web, but about the web, such as Click, Click, Click. Yeah. This is like a web browser game that reflects. There's basically only one button you can click. And while you click it, you hear a voice telling you all the things that it learns about you while you click this button. So, and it's a lot.
It's like articulating all the trackers or something?
Yes, it is about that, all these behaviors. And
There's two things. It just lists all the event handlers, basically. But it also analyzes it in a very rudimentary way. But it just somehow tries to project something personal on you based, so it does some sort of a layer of interpretation. And that's mostly, let's say, very rudimentary, but it feels really real because you move, this person is slower than average, maybe, and it's 9 o'clock, so maybe he just woke up, something like this. So very, very simple things, but it immediately comes very close to you,
and you get a different feel kind of feedback.
You feel like, hey, this is not like a neutral behavior that I'm doing here. Uh-huh. This time of the year, it's in this time zone. Uh-huh. It makes like
So it's all about making you aware that there's so much information from you captured and also analyzed and used.
Would you say that that's the kind of friction that you're after, like making these things?
No, that's exactly or? That's exactly what we say. No, but you're asking about how did it evolve? Does it evolve that we come to now this mentality, and that is also that during making all those critical works that reflect our online behavior, there were several other ones. It is a little bit like, let's not make another critical work about it, but also think about then, what do we like to do? What do we think then how it should be? And so basically, rather than only criticizing how it is, looking a little bit in a different direction. Yeah. So there are several ways now which we, first of all, asking a different question, and second, also the sort of media that we want to use in the future.
Yeah, that's nice how you say that.
You say that in the past you were more like doing critical projects about.
Now, first of all, we were making super optimistic work and celebrating it. Also critical, but much more investigating the space. Then
like
we
the
started
honeymoon phase of the internet.
Yeah, like that.
Exactly.
Like show the possibility.
Yeah.
Show
the
possibility.
Exactly. Yeah. And then slowly we start to the topic itself of the web project was more of a critique. About our online behavior, about censorship, online censorship,
privacy,
about privacy, also, about social networks. We do not touch for luck. Anyway, that, and then happened what I just described.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's also a bit of the you could say the day and age of this time. I mean, I think there's I think lots of people have enough head with people saying what's wrong. I think it's also time to somehow try to see, okay, what is then a new direction? What's a new set of tools that we as designers could use, and what's considered design? You know, also this whole idea of make new product and an extra thing in the world. Is it really about that? Or is it more about how can we use these tools to really create a social coherent society? I mean, that sounds super ambitious, but if there's just this tiny little thing that helps, it's already very nice. I think I remember that we also for the VPRO had this basically it was really a precursor of this friction design. It was really there was in the beginning of somehow halfway populism, Trump era, that we thought, everybody's in this bubble and we need to somehow find try to find an infrastructure that makes people go out of their bubble. And you know, then we had endless talks about how can we use to facilitate and it never really became a fruitful project because we didn't realize the web as a sort of place for really engaging in these kind of things was already maybe not so the space was so small at the time already. And now we are way more aware of that and we also don't mind anymore. I think it's just something that has, we mind. It's but we're not going to keep lamenting on it. You know, it's just, it's now in different ways.
Yeah. I like it. It's also, I think, a good challenge for you, but I think artists, designers in general, that, of course, we can envision the end of the world over and over.
Exactly.
In a way, part of art history. Yeah. But in a way, it's much more challenging to envision a world where you actually want to live in.
Yeah.
And your children as well. And what's the direction for that?
Yeah, what's the substance we need for this? And the tools.
And we have all the, we have all these amazing technologies.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so much potential, both in humans and in technology.
Yeah.
And we are steering it into a very narrow,
specific path. Mm-hmm.
So
it also feels a little bit that we sort of step back from practicing it a bit, but really step out of it and then trying to find a new set of tools, a new set of a way of working, and then maybe engage again.
Say it maybe not a set of tools, but a thinking framework.
There's this thing that you mentioned earlier about technology as something that is now competing with us, or I think often it's also misunderstood. It's not the nature of technology itself that does that. It's really maybe more the way we apply it, right? And we can do that in all kinds of ways. And we need to keep telling this ourselves. It's us who decide what is the role of this technology. Where do you use the tool for?
Yeah, although certain tools or certain technology, in a way, have some kind of behavior already kind of cooked in.
Built
them,
in.
Right? I have this a little observation that I Well, I told you I live in New York currently. Yeah. And as well, you will know that the United States is this tipping culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite different than here in tipping. Like if you go to a restaurant, you tip.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the bill comes.
Yeah.
And what's happening often when you go to a bar, you buy a beer, and you pay with your card. So then in the what is it, the card machine, mm-hmm. there's already the tip is mm-hmm. pre-calculated. Mm-hmm. So 10 years ago, when I was in New York, it was like 10%, 15%. But now it's like 18%, 25%, 30%. Like, whoa, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just press a button, and it's already kind of calculated for you. You mm-hmm. don't have to kind of write the number yourself,
mm-hmm.
or you don't have to
say like, "Hey,
you don't have to engage in a conversation."
Yeah, but is that good or not?
Well, what I was going to, like, in a way, it's kind of, I think the goal of that is to indeed make it frictionless.
Mm-hmm.
Just press a button, and you get this mm-hmm. messy conversation out of the way. But then, what happens if you choose? Let's say I'm not so happy with the mm-hmm. bartender, and I just say like, "Oh, 10% or like 0% is also an option."
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
then the percentage is displayed on the device for like minutes. So you hand it back and they see like, "Oh, this dude just gave me 5%.
Yeah, yeah, incredible.
It's like really kind of awkward situation.
Yeah, yeah. It is and much like, heavier than if you would just say it, something like that, and like 2 seconds and then over. And huh?
Everybody I talked to in New York is talking about, like, it's such an awkward moment that you have to hand back the device. Like, oh, sorry.
It is smart.
But it's of course, it's like also cooked into the device because mm-hmm. they want you kind of,
mm-hmm.
they want you to give more tip because the bank somehow makes a profit off your tip as well.
Yeah, Yeah, probably the restaurant also is benefiting, like probably the average tip is higher than before.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
But my point is that this awkward moment could also be a beautiful moment of human interaction, right?
There's
potential. There's so much
things going
interactions
on.
Yeah. happening. There's so many
but not verbal
bills being
ones.
Paid. Like, not verbal. So you, like what could potentially be a nice human interaction, you could even say something like thank you for the service or the time. It's reduced to this like one click button and then even made it very awkward. And but even in the how we design those situations, like you mentioned, the Uber driver, there's so much potential for enriching our lives, right?
It's
becoming such a poor derivative of what it could be.
But that's what I mean, the premise of, you know, instead of optimizing in that sense,
exactly.
you know. Reverse it, right? Instead of making it faster, make things, processes slower, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? To think already this thinking construct of make things slower due to digital technology is so weird. And I'm curious about that because nobody has, everybody, it's too much. We cannot grasp everything. We have so many possibilities because of the speed to fill our lives with so many things. 1 second, that we are rushing. Everybody's rushing after all those things in their lives.
But what I'm very curious about is like, how do you, if the majority of this the people who pay for these apps and the development of these things, they are often, they're not after, their incentive is not per se to make you slower and more relaxed. So
earning money, you mean?
Yeah, so how is this financed?
But
let's continue. Is this something that should be maybe then stay? You could say it's a responsibility for the commons. It's something that's way more political rather than, because you cannot leave this to our capitalist society. It will never happen. It's something that has to come from somehow a movement or a bigger story. Then it's not something that you can
But I don't know, when you have, if you truly believe that your life gets better in a certain way, you will pay for it.
Yeah, but then in the end it's still a business model, so then like everything is allowed again. So I think that, I mean,
yeah, but then the goal is a different one.
No, the goal is then if you pay for it, then in the end
you think it's good for you.
No, then there's somebody profiting, and that means that there's not, the incentive is not to make you happy. This incentive is then to get you to somehow make you pay.
Could it be both?
It could be both. But
why not?
It could be both, but I think there's not so many successful projects in that regard. In the end, it's really, that's also what transformed the whole web to like a very horrible place. because that's in the end the incentive.
No, but I don't agree.
Okay, now that's super interesting to find a case then where that would be.
That's what I mean.
What's wrong with like saying this is a responsibility for like something like more a movement or a governmental or maybe even.
But if the movement, if in all our brains will change, ideology will change because we think how things are going are not, we cannot maintain it, then the awareness will change slowly. The government will be part of it, but also companies will tap in, obviously. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think here I tend to go a little bit with you, Luna, because if I understand you correctly, you're more in favor of a more, even more like a radical paradigm shift about what is technology in the first place, rather than saying like, oh, it should be faster or slower, or it should be.
Yeah, the only thing I'm saying, you should not leave that up to capital society or whatever.
No, the origins, come probably not maybe from big capital, but.
Yeah. I had to think about a conversation I had a while ago with somebody from Peru who has Inca roots, so to speak. And he was telling me a bit about the Inca cosmovision, how they see the world. And they have, like in this culture, there's two very important energies. Like one is called Pachamama, that's like nature, including our bodies, including everything, like say, the material part of nature, like all the stuff in the universe. And as Pachacamac, with more like energy, thought, intelligence, conscious, if you want. And these two, they're in balance. In the Eastern philosophies, they would say like yin and yang, something like that. But how they see it is that the technology we produce, it's part of this. It's part of this whole. You know, like our human bodies are as much part of the whole as any technology that we produce. It's a oneness.
Technology is part of the physical part of this whole, the both together. Like the energy and the not materialistic and the materialistic.
I think they see it as both. But what I find so interesting is that, it's such a paradigm shift to really see that as one whole thing. That if we create technologies that are harmful to the planet or to people, that in a way you're harming yourself because you're part of that whole. I mean, that story.
That's super nice the way to put it. I think that's also every child will understand this. But I think in reality, if you leave that up to corporates, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So there, I think then that's also why democracy and why, like, let's say, like the whole idea of like having some sort of a group of people we trust, some authority can somehow, at least should have the capacity to somehow force like specific kind of regulations, let's call it regulations on the world around us, is the way to somehow get like step by step implement this kind of thinking that somehow you pay tax on like removing interaction. Let's put it, it's a very weird idea, but you know, I think that is the way to go rather than say like, okay, now you have to understand if you make somehow give a corporate, you know, they will pay even more if they find out that they have found this beautiful, frictionful fight with your neighbor, you know? And then you make up again and you have like a good party because you follow each other. It's not going to happen like that. I think people are also, in the end, they just like convenience and like, I mean, they're also a bit anxious. I mean, I'm also happy with Uber often, you know? Although I know that if I'm like confronted with like a sweaty person in a stinky shirt in the thing. Of course, this is something that in the end I will value maybe more. But at the moment, I just like Starbucks, and just like having everything like smooth out for a second. And I think there's like this weird contradiction, like in what we basically do easily and what we so have for convenience, and what maybe in the end turns out to be the nicer thing. I think it's super hard to capitalize. I mean, we have talked about this too much. If you think about the business model around that, I really didn't see anything that somehow has the slightest hint of being successful.
And what we've also talked earlier about, Rule and Me, then, that I think is also crazy, that whole focus on pleasure, that idea that everything our lives must be as also pleasurable, or I don't know how to say it with other words, but there should not be any friction or anything that goes bad or sweaty, or it's all about maximizing comfort and maximizing joy, happiness all the time. It's all about that. If you feel this, is you get confronted at least with this when if you are a lot.
But we are kind of Calvinistic. Like, I mean, we sort of embrace this kind of thing. Like, also,
it's just a way. I think it's interesting to talk about it, to think about it, how much this is sold as a goal in life. You know?
Yeah. So it's maximizing pleasure, but also like minimizing discomfort.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? That
whole
goes together.
Industry is based on that.
And there's like lots of, let's say, media that sort of profit from that. And I, especially in the States, I hope you might know this better than us, but even like fully intellectually, like well-thinking people just don't let their children not watch the news anymore and watch themselves not anymore, because they just feel like they don't become happy from it. Mm. You know, they just ignore it completely. I think that, I mean, that is... That's like, so it's called the cuddle generation or something. Like the whole idea that you just don't want to expose yourself to negativity because it's just harmful. I see it also with parents and parenting. Like I had like a situation with a child that I worked for a whole day on all kinds of carpentry things. And he was like an active kid, was also very present, but super active, gave all the tools. We were working together on something big. At the end of the day, we went to the beach, wanted to have food. And he had to wait a bit. He already had something, but I said, he wanted more. I said, like, you have to wait until everybody had. And he was tired, hungry, couldn't handle it, ran away crying. I thought, that's fine. You know, you're okay. It's okay that you cry now. I mean, you know, you will sort it out. I already, you know, I will say something for you. It will be fine. But then some other parents said to me, like, hey, you really can. I think you have to go and console him.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt really...
And apologize.
And I felt like, hey, I know this kid.
Apologize.
We have a relationship together. It's not that I somehow break into something. And I found it super difficult. And I really felt like a fundamental difference in, like, parenting. Like, the way I like to somehow... I think it's done just like it's
okay how you
to
want
cry.
To present the world, right?
Yeah,
how you want to stand in the world.
It's fine that you cry about things you don't like. It's all cool. I'm not judging that, but I'm also not saying like, "Hey, I'm sorry, I harmed you." It's just like it's just so clear to me. I think if I would apologize, it would harm the whole. It would be very harmful for the whole dynamic in this situation.
Yeah, anyway. Because you're essentially apologizing for. Yeah, for what exactly? Yeah. For not giving me a treat.
I said, now wegwezen or something, you know? Yeah. Like, you already had, like, wait for the others. And then he couldn't handle it. It's fine, you know? Yeah.
It's nice that you bring up this anecdote. The one question I had in mind, you both have families, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does having a family, has it affected your outlook on the world, but maybe also your creative practices?
It definitely has. Your kid grows up, how do you want your kid to grow up with a phone and computer, media, games? There you have to define an idea about it or form an idea about it. And as we are very much into in this practice, informed, you could say. My view on that is also rather developed. And then I took action based on that. And also I formed personally a group in school, in the basic school, with other teachers, with other parents, to develop a vision. And I must say, I'm a bit more strict and conservative concerning that. So my kid is one of the few that has no phone yet. I'm very happy for her that she does not need to deal with this bullshit. Let's put it that way. 11.
Right. Yeah, that's the type of age that they probably want this.
She does not? No, she's fine with she knows she gets one when she gets to high school, and she's okay with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you told me about this, like, parenting group or a group of parents that you form some kind of discussion platform, or has it produced anything?
Yeah, we have written a document with a vision how the school should deal with digital media that concerns about the rules it should apply to, privacy, you know, ideally open source, what kind of platforms the school uses for digital technology.
Like, show by doing.
Yeah, but also we just have written an abstract document that can be used, a vision that can be used in future years, that you can check all the decisions that you take upon this document, that it's still valid.
There's also something in there for mobile phone use in school?
Yes, there is no, they are not allowed to use the phone in school.
Does this project or this document, did it get any traction outside the school?
No.
You have
so
any
not published like that?
No, but we are collaborating with another school, which also has this document. They use it also. And I also want to add that we have also a very beautiful parent in that school, and she teaches also to the group of where my kid is in, and also the next year, about, we call it computational thinking, about how to learn about computational thinking, about coding, about what is it without using a computer itself, without any screens. For example, the teacher, the kids of the class need to program the teacher, tell him what to do in order to make a bread sandwich with butter and jam on it. Nice. You know, you have the tools, program the teacher just always only does what the kid says.
Like providing with the scripts.
With a script, right, live. And the it's always going wrong. And then you said, you know, that's a very simple example, which is fun ideas there, what you do.
But it's so cool. Yeah. We talked about your families. You also both are art educator, or you have been. Do you still have current positions?
No.
Is that something of the past?
Yeah.
How do you...
Well, we give sometimes workshops.
Right.
We have the last workshop we've given together was a very funny example. Yeah. It sounds like we are very tech pessimists right now also, you know, like... but I mean, we just say we're critical about it. We try to really think in which way should we use technology for a better way.
Yeah,
but what we have done... Sorry?
I just wanted to add to that you are also very optimist people. You come across as very optimist, hopeful people about humans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think that's to keep it...
That's the core. Yeah, exactly.
I think also now we slowly have the beginning of formulating something new, like this friction design. It's way less pessimistic, I would say. It's actually a very hopeful thing.
Yeah.
Because it's somehow...
Exactly. We think about in which way... Should it happen then? But what we did there, what kind of workshop is that we let them not use any screen for 4 days. And then they thought when they came to the course at the beginning, fine, we can do that just during the course. But then evening, David. But we said, no, that's a misunderstanding. We don't allow you to let you use your phone or your computer for 4 days long in total.
Yeah.
And that was so funny because it was such a drama. It was like they got amputated and there was lots of tears and problems. And we were spending basically 4 days
in
sort of therapy, coming up for alternative solutions. But in the end, they had the best time of their lives.
Yeah.
So that was so for us as well. We did the same thing. Mm-hmm. I had a great time during that 4 days.
Yeah.
I was also feeling so much relieved. Lots of stuff was just off my shoulders.
But we didn't teach for a while. But now, actually, slowly, I also get more and more like, because we're also a bit dumb. I think we both had the feeling at one point, makes sense now also what we described. Like, we also didn't want to be the techno pessimist and like being like always like a media critical and like point to, let's say, privacy and all these things, you know, at one point also becomes a bit exhausting.
Yeah.
But I think now slowly I feel there's a beginning of something that I like to investigate together with Luna, but also with students about what that is to somehow do this friction design and what is it exactly, except for like a theory, okay, we want to change it, but it doesn't have any, let's say, conceptual or commercial or like applied success yet. I mean, not indexed or visualized, you know, we don't have really some substance around it yet. And I think that is very nice too.
Yeah.
But we,
And it's such a beautiful area to explore with students as well.
Yeah,
and totally. I feel that myself too, that for a few years, let's say the past 10 years, some point, speculative design became very important, critical design, and everything is about like technology and how bad the world was going. And
I was completely done with that.
I mean, in a way, there's still room for like proper, criticism.
Of course, of course.
And there's always kind of be some people who do that. But I often also get feedback, or we as teachers get feedback from students who say, like, oh, why do everything always has to be critical or something? And in a way, I get them, because it's way more fun and also more human to think about, oh, what's actually the thing that you want?
Mm-hmm. What's ahead? Yeah,
it's a more positive way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Like, what's also more hopeful for the future? What is the world that you want to live in?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it in design that and have the full human experience with all everything in it, and make that part of the assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, don't mean literally the school assignment, but the assignment in life, like where we can direct our energy to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Well, that's great.
Great finale.
Yeah. Should we leave it here?
I would say so.
I think so too.
Guys, thank you so much for this conversation. It was really super interesting. I'm curious where you stand in a year or in 10 years.
Yeah.
You're going to design friction in the coming years. I want to be in that world. I want to live there.
Welcome.
I know for a fact, knowing you as people, but also knowing your work, that you will do something amazing with that, and you're going to lead the way. So show us. And I hope we can continue this conversation at some point.
Yeah.
Behind the microphone or behind the beer.
Yeah.
But
thank you so much.
Yes.
Design Alchemy is brought to you by GDA, which stands for Graphic Design Arnhem, a 4-year bachelor program in experimental graphic design. GDA is part of Arthas University of the Arts, location Arnhem, the Netherlands, Europe. I wish to make some acknowledgements and shoutouts because I don't make this podcast on my own. First, I would like to say a big thank you to all the guests in this podcast. Friends, if you're listening, you know who you are. A podcast like this would be nowhere without you. I also want to thank some colleagues from Arthas. Maaike van Neck, GDA Head of Department for Critical Support. Iris Janssen, Miret Pelgrom, Marlies Staporsjes, and Elsje Buehler, all colleagues from Arthas University of the Arts, that helped with distribution and promotion. And I would like to thank myself for coming up with the idea of the podcast and making it happen. And last but not least, I want to thank you, dear listener, to making it all the way until here. We make this content for you, and I truly hope that you got something out of this episode. If you believe you have a story to share for Design Alchemy, please send me an email. You can send it to h.grievink@arthez.nl. That's ARTEZ.NL. Everybody, thank you so much for working your magic.